an amendment on the other, while championing the environment and a sustainable healthcare plan, all falling under the umbrella of freedom, resonated. Later, there would be those who would accuse his friends in that early tech startup of manipulating social media algorithms to get one of their own into the White House. Was that true? Even Alec didn't know for certain. What most people saw was a young, vibrant, wealthy, handsome candidate with a background tailor-made for politics. He fit the fairy tale. Though many in his own party despised his success, the elites also saw him as a future presidential candidate. There was even talk of a presidential run early on, especially after he took the stage as a newly minted congressman at the 2008 Democratic Convention in opposition to the war in Iraq. They had wanted to trot out a respected young anti-war face of the party as a way to solidify the youth vote during a time when support for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan was at an all-time low. As always, Alec was thoughtful in his remarks, well-informed on geopolitics, and most important, likable, causing many commentators to wonder aloud why the Democratic Party wasn't running him, at least as a VP pick. Alec was patient. He learned how Washington worked. He cultivated the relationships that would allow him to operate effectively in the swamp while remaining popular in California, a state he would have to win in a presidential bid. He laid the groundwork, continued to build his social platforms, and harness their power. No longer was he dependent on the kingmakers of the legacy media establishment. Their power was waning, but they were too self-absorbed to notice. He built his own platforms in the new media and focused his messaging on those who digested their news via their smartphones and made their decisions largely based on influencers. He started a podcast before most people even knew what they were. Legacy print and cable media scoffed at him, but by the time he announced his campaign for the 2020 presidential election, his podcast reach dwarfed the ratings of those in conventional media, the same media that continued to make cynical comments night after night from their sound stages in New York, D.C., and Atlanta. He could talk directly to the people and continue to build his base through engaging content and considerate conversations. He dominated the new media space in a way the rest of the Democratic field could only dream about. He studied the data, capitalized on relationships with influencers to co-opt segments of their audiences, and built a voting bloc powerful enough to sway an election. That power made the party elite nervous. He was not under their control and therefore was unpredictable, but they also saw him as a way back into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Both Alec and the party leadership knew he would have to go farther left for his vice presidential pick to balance the ticket, a chance to keep power for a 16-year run. If they wanted to fundamentally transform the country, they were going to have to support the popular congressman. His vice presidential pick from Florida's 9th district made him the first president in U.S. history to win with a female on the ticket. The fact that she was an Army JAG Corps veteran and of Cuban descent brought in the electoral votes from one of the more hotly contested battleground states in recent history. That she remained a major in the National Guard and outranked the new commander-in-chief, who had been medically retired as a first lieutenant due to his combat injuries, was a source of ample comedic material for the late-night talk shows. Even the women of The View could not stop themselves from fawning all over them both. It kept Alec center stage and made him relatable. As the most eligible bachelor in D.C., he was a staple on the covers of magazines at supermarket checkout lines. In a world where a reality show about finding love trumped ratings across the board, he was a star. He enjoyed female company, but it always became clear after a few months that they would never be his top priority. Truth be told, his attention was on a ghost, one that was never far away. Alec turned from the window and looked down at the resolute desk. which had been a part of the room since Queen Victoria had presented it to President Rutherford B. Hayes in 1880. It was built from wood, recovered from the HMS Resolute, a British ship that was abandoned after becoming trapped in the ice while on an Arctic expedition in 1854. An American whaler recovered the ship 2 years later and returned it to the United Kingdom. President Christensen looked at it as a symbol of hope and resolve. Just shy of 100 years after fighting the war for independence, the former colonial rulers gifted a desk made from one of their naval vessels to the leader of the country that defeated them. After contentious beginnings and the war that birthed a nation, the two countries had become the staunchest of allies. He rarely walked into the Oval Office without thinking of the iconic photo of JFK working that very desk with John Jr. peeking out through the knee-hole panel at his feet, a photo that would not be published until after the assassination in Dallas. President Christensen took a breath and looked at the four files on his desk. They had been delivered by his national security advisor that morning. Three of them were the reason for the journey he'd taken over the past 20 years. The president is the only person in all of government who has unfettered access to the nation's most closely guarded secrets. Everyone else is read into and out of special access programs based on need to know. Information is compartmentalized for reasons of national security. The real trick is knowing what to ask for and where to look. The young president was searching for something specific. Alec had not made his request immediately upon taking office. He had already waited 2 decades. He could wait a few more months. The new president needed to learn, research, and plan. He needed to lead. He had inherited a country still reeling from the economic repercussions of an almost complete shutdown in response to a virus that had originated halfway around the world. The follow-on civil unrest had devastated the nation. Those wounds were slowly healing, in large part due to Alec's leadership. He'd had access to some of the documents included in the files when he was in Congress, but there were two new files that he was particularly interested in today. The commander-in-chief pressed his knuckles into the oak timbers of the presidential desk, his left hand still bearing the scars from the Taliban bullet, the tinnitus in his ears from the IED reminding him that he'd never truly be at peace. That was okay. Peace was not what he was after. He'd already read two of the files front to back. They were stacked to his left. Alec looked down at the two remaining folders. One was labeled Executive Order 12333. He flipped to Part 2, Paragraph 13, Prohibition on Assassination. His eyes scanned the section of the order, a version of which had been signed or strengthened by every president since Gerald Ford. No person employed by or acting on behalf of the United States government shall engage in or conspire to engage in assassination. The president then shifted his gaze to the last file. It had been delivered by the CIA that morning and passed to the National Security Advisor, who in turn had placed it on the president's desk. It was labeled Director of National Intelligence, Top Secret, Psi Gamma, TK, HCS, RSV, KDK, No Forn, Handle via Executive Channels Only. Under those code words and control labels was a name, James Reese. The president flipped the page and began to read. Chapter 5. John F. Kennedy International Airport, New York, New York. Ali Reza Ansari made sure he wasn't the first to exit the jetway. He didn't want to look overly eager to anyone monitoring the cameras or facial recognition programs, constantly scanning every face deplaning in one of the busiest airports on Earth. He'd specified with his travel department that he'd like a window seat near the rear of the business class cabin. That would be expected for someone in his position and would put him near the back of the first pack of deplaning passengers. He'd been with Biodyne Medical Systems for 17 years. A global healthcare company headquartered in Switzerland, it boasted research and manufacturing facilities in Germany, Switzerland, Ireland, Canada, and what they referred to as the Central Eastern European region. Ali had first interned with them as a graduate student pursuing dual-track business and pharmaceutical sciences degrees from Saarland University in Germany. Biodyne was also one of the few biomedical research companies with research and distribution networks in both the United States and Iran. Biodyne was a respected, progressive, and diverse company that traced its roots back to 1758, when it was founded as a trading business specializing in chemicals, dyes, and pharmaceuticals. It was called Andros and Sons then, and for their first 100 years they focused on producing alizarin blue and oramine dyes. It wasn't until the late 1800s that they developed a medical-grade pharmaceutical, an antiseptic for soothing arthritis. With that success, the company shifted to the research and development of medicines in their Basel, Switzerland chemical plant. In 1971, they sold to Glencore Trading Company. That merger gave them international reach through research labs and manufacturing plants in Europe, North America, and the Middle East. In 1997, they merged again, this time with one of the largest healthcare companies in the world, becoming Biodyne, with biomedical research labs in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Tehran, Iran, through a partnership with the Iranian Communicable Disease Research Center. Ali got into the line for non-U.S. citizens and waited patiently for his turn with the Customs and Border Protection official, who opened his Swiss passport and compared the photo to the man on the other side of the glass. Ali offered a pleasant smile as the uniformed officer scanned the barcode and shifted his eyes to the computer. Why the United States did not screen passengers ahead of time, like El Al, Ali would never understand. He'd also never fly El Al.
"What is the purpose of your visit?" the CBP officer asked.
"Business," Ali replied with only the slightest hint of an accent, as he'd done at least 100 times over the years.
"And what kind of business is that?"
"A medical device technology company," Ali replied, not offering any more than required.
Pharmaceuticals had the tendency to be off-putting with so much bad press around the opioid epidemic in America. It seemed as if the venerable news program 60 Minutes ran weekly segments on Big Pharma's shady lobbying and marketing practices, pointing out that opioids killed more Americans annually than were killed during the entire Vietnam War. What the West called terrorism had nothing on opioids. Even though Biodyne did not manufacture the devastating drugs, Ali did not want to highlight the pharmaceutical side of the company to someone who might be related to one of the thousands affected by a highly addictive narcotic. The official flipped pages in the passport looking for stamps from Yemen, Afghanistan, or Pakistan, which would lead to additional questions and a possible secondary screening.
"How long will you be staying in the United States?"
"About a week," Ali lied.
The official found a blank page and stamped it with an entry date before returning Ali's passport under the plexiglass partition.
"Enjoy your stay," he said,
nodding to the next person in line. Ali made his way casually into the international baggage claim, noting exits and careful to pay just the right amount of attention to the armed police patrolling the area. He was also sure to force a disarming smile when he passed by a police officer with one of the Americans' canines by his side. Americans loved their dogs. Filthy animals. Senior lab manager with one of the world's leading medical technology companies was not the career field to which Ali aspired in his youth. He'd only wanted to kill Iraqis and Americans. Ali couldn't even remember the last time he'd seen his father. He was still in the crawling stage when his dad was conscripted into military service. 2 years later, his oldest brother would leave for the front lines, followed 5 years later by his middle brother, who would fight in the final battles of the Holy Defense, a conflict the rest of the world insisted on calling the Iran-Iraq War. His mother had not been notified by a knock on the door as he'd seen in so many American movies. Rather, a list of the dead and missing was posted each week in the town square. The list was displayed a good distance from the Provincial Society office, the locally elected Islamic council responsible for coordinating regional affairs with the Islamic Consultative Assembly in Tehran. The politicians seemed more afraid of backlash from Iranian mothers and widows than they were of invading Iraqi forces. Young Ali would accompany his mother to town each week in search of news. She would leave him in a chair by a butcher stand on the corner and push her way through the crowds to read the names, praying to Allah for the safe return of her loved ones. The stench of rotting meat behind the thin curtain would stay with Ali the remainder of his life. He could live with the smell. What haunted his dreams were the wailings of the women, their screams as they read the names of husbands and sons they'd never see again, would fuel his every decision. The list offered no cause of death, no locations. The bodies were buried on the battlefield out of necessity, often in mass graves. Rarely was it possible for the dead to receive a proper Islamic burial as mandated by Sharia law. In wartime, one must make sacrifices. They would mourn his older brother first, killed in the early days of the war in a human wave attack in the marshes of Basra in 1982. At 15 years of age, he'd received a week of training before being sent to the front lines. The cult of the martyr had become a powerful instrument of the state. Whether he was killed by artillery, rockets, tanks, or small arms fire, or hunted down by the devastatingly effective Mi-25 helicopters, using the same hunter-killer tactics the Soviets had used against the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, Ali would never know. His only connection to his older sibling would come years later in the Iranian Martyrs Museum in Tehran, where he'd found his brother's picture encased under a glass display. Additional research would reveal that his father had been a victim of a sarin gas attack in the town of Halabja, Iraq, in March 1988. As a soldier and then university student, Ali would spend hours sifting through available photographs of the battle, trying to identify his father among the bloated bodies of the dead. Iraq's chemical weapon attacks would kill thousands of Iranians and expose even more to the deadly contaminants. Even 30 years following the UN-brokered end of hostilities, close to 100,000 Iranians were still receiving medical treatment for the lifelong effects of the toxins. Open-source declassified CIA documents would confirm that by 1984, the American Intelligence Agency was aware of Iraq's use of chemical weapons in violation of international law. An ally of Iraq, the United States not only remained silent, but ramped up their military and intelligence support of Saddam Hussein's troops, even using their clout with the United Nations Security Council to block condemnation of Iraq when UN investigators presented unrefuted proof of the use of banned weapons by the Iraqi regime. Free of condemnation, Iraq increased its use of weaponized neurotoxins through the end of the war in 1988. Ugly things are done in times of war, Ali knew. Heads are turned. Reports are falsified. Evidence is buried. The United States should have done a better job at covering their tracks. It was U.S. satellite imagery provided to Iraq that allowed them to effectively target advancing Iranian troops that March day in 1988, the day Ali's father was killed. The Americans were responsible for the excruciating deaths that morning. Bodies of women and children scattered among the soldiers, their faces contorted in agony. Gas was not a precision weapon system and did not discriminate between combatants and civilians. In 1982, deciding that an Iranian victory was contrary to U.S. foreign policy objectives, President Reagan removed Iraq from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. The military-industrial complex, about which Eisenhower had so solemnly warned, was in full swing. War was big business. Reagan's actions opened the door to military equipment and munitions sales to include the dual-use technology that would allow Iraq to produce and weaponize the chemicals that would give them the upper hand against the Iranians. The same poisons that had altered the course of Ali's life. In the popular press, Iran was portrayed as the instigator, which made it easier for the world to support the Ba'athists in Iraq. With $1 billion a month flowing in from Saudi Arabia, Iraq was able to purchase weapons from the United States, the Soviet Union, and the countries of Western Europe. Howitzers, Exocet missiles, Gazelle helicopters,